Wow. Yeah.
Well, good. And then Warm Leatherette, and then that's how I knew you were on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a big hit. You're telling me it was more of a...
I mean, it was big in that world. It wasn't a big commercial hit, but it was in that world of... I mean, yeah, I guess it was a hit. I don't know, yeah.
Yes, well, there's nothing else like it, and it's so simple and easy to get and yet play over and over.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. What luck.
I remember, just once, funny, talking about playing it, I was trying to get into the... There was this whole new movement in Britain called the New Romantic.
Oh, thing. Yeah, I remember that.
There's a club called The Blitz, which was like the home of New Romantic things. And I wasn't really into that at all. And I certainly didn't look like, you know. But I was with a friend who'd come from overseas. And she said, oh, can we go to The Blitz Club? I said, well, I don't know. Yeah, we can try. But we don't. I don't know if we'll get in. Because I knew there was this, like, heavy-duty dress code, you know. And we were just dressed like, you know... probably dressed in black or something, I don't know, whatever, and not colourful enough. And I remember going to the door and trying to get in, and it was the guy, the famous guy who was the doorman, was Steve Strange.
Oh, I remember him.
Yeah, he was the kind of, he was the gatekeeper.
I went to a party with him in London. Yeah. I mean, he was that in London, but anyway.
He was the gate, and he said, no. And what, as he was refusing entry, I could hear my record being played in the club.
Oh, my God. What timing. You should have said that.
Well, somebody, no, but then somebody came to him and said, oh, I think you can let him in. I don't know who, So that was just funny, saying, no, sorry, you can't come in. And I could hear my record being played in the club.
Yeah. Wow. You mean, was that Warm Leatherette?
Yeah, Warm Leatherette, yeah.
Okay.
It was big in that scene, you know. Yeah. The New Romantic scene.
They all had hair in their eyes.
I know, it's very impractical.
Very
high maintenance.
Gaudy. Yeah, too high maintenance. What a pain in the, you know what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too much time.
Too much time in front of the mirror.
Yeah, exactly.
I know, I'm kind of an anti-narcissist.
Yeah.
For myself, I don't care what anyone else does. Wow. So, now, it's only a few weeks ago I read this terrible quotation. Sooner or later, every artist comes to retail. In other words, you know, there's art and there's commerce.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought this morning, well, you went to wholesale real fast because you started, you know, a label that seemed like it took off, like, fast.
Yeah. In retrospect, yeah. It did.
And that reflects your aesthetic. I hate that word curatorial or curate.
Yeah, it's one of those words, overused words.
It's
a
horrible, pretentious word.
I think a curator has to have a smoke a pipe and, you know, just sort of have a, you know, dusty books, you know, and paintings and stuff like that.
But you tell me about how you got Mute off the ground. Because that was you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's based, you know what we people like you and me do, we don't change aesthetics, but we present our aesthetics, and people are drawn to it or not.
I guess that's what it is.
But I only thought of that recently.
Yeah. No, it's
not
true.
Not forever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in other words...
So I had no intention of starting a record label.
Really?
No. I just wanted to put out one single to see how it felt.
Okay.
Really just to see, have the kind of experience of it, you know.
Yeah.
So I had no I didn't think about starting a record label in the sense of working with other artists. And I didn't do anything about it for a while. I got demos sent to me because I had my address on the back of the sleeve. And there were some quite interesting things that there was one group who ended up on Rough Trade who I actually sort of produced, I don't know, called File Under Pop. I don't know if you remember them.
Called what?
File Under Pop.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, they did this thing live at Heathrow Airport. The record, 7-inch. Like, you know, I heard of them. I got to know them through that, and they ended up on Mute actually under various names. But so they actually recorded it live at Heathrow Airport. They
recorded it at Heathrow.
Yeah, they had like three ghetto blasters or whatever that was playing stuff, and then they walked around, and then one of them was standing with a microphone recording it as they walked around Heathrow. I don't know, I think they got chucked out after a few minutes, but they got enough stuff to put out a single.
That's
I don't know, I guess it's still out there somewhere.
Good. Guerrilla recording or something.
But anyway, so I got some of these demos, and I thought, why am I getting these demos? I don't really like it that much. I don't know what they want, or I didn't really understand, And but about a year after, So I did put out the record, and I did those gigs, and I actually started working for Rough Trade a little bit, helping them out there, and pressing record, getting my records pressed, and just thinking about what I was going to do. And then I was introduced. There's a cartoonist called Savage Pencil.
Oh, I know him.
Edwin Pouncey, yeah. He was somebody I knew a bit from the whole Rough Trade milieu, and he said that, and there's this guy living in his flat who was making demos in the cupboard in his flat, and he said, you might like it, and he played it to me, and it was, of all the things that I'd heard, I really liked it. It's Fad Gadget. It was the early Fad Gadget demos. And I met Frank Tovey, who was Fad Gadget, and we got on really, really well, and really had shared kind of humor and aesthetic and everything. And I took the plunge, and I said, let's do a single. I'll release a single. And that's kind of when Mute Records started as a label, Talking of shared aesthetics, and this is before, because I know that this relates somehow to research and history. Before that, very early days of releasing my single, I met, I was in the shop, I was in the Rough Trade shop, and this Judith, who was working there, said, you should meet this guy, he's just come in, he loves your single, and he's selling some of his records, and it was Boyd Rice.
Right.
And he had the copies of his Black Album.
Right.
And he was a kid, he was very young in those days. And we ended up doing some stuff together at that point, which ended up on the Los Angeles Free Music Society album called Cleanliness and Order.
Mm.
Sorry, that was just a side thing, but I just wanted to mention. And that's when I first met Boyd.
That's right. I forgot. You and Boyd collaborated on
that's
recordings.
Right. Yeah.
That ended up at LAFMS put out. I just saw Tom Rescione.
Okay.
He's one of the principals of that label.
Okay.
I saw him in LA
a
couple of weeks ago or something. Yeah, well, wow.
Yeah, but that was
thanks for reminding me that recording exists.
Yeah, and I went in the studio with Frank. Neither of us had been to a recording studio before.
Wow.
Because I'd all just done my stuff at home at that point. And we were kind of nervous, I guess. I don't know what we didn't really know. We actually had a very clear idea of what we wanted to do in the studio. We had a drum machine, because he had a drum machine, which was kind of a Korg Mini Pops drum machine, and we'd figured out how we would, because that had just one output. You couldn't change the rhythm, you couldn't program rhythms on it or anything like that. It just had like 10 preset rhythms.
Hmm.
And we'd figured out that we could split the output and defect one output and not the other. We kind of had an idea of what we wanted to do. We never actually had practical application to do it. So we went in and I kind of produced it, I suppose, because I knew slightly more about the process than he did. That's been my thing, always knowing slightly more about something, so we recorded Back to Nature and The Box, which is the first single. Again, we did both in a day.
Wow.
Recorded and mixed it.
An 8-hour day or a 12-hour day?
Right. 18 hours, I don't know.
Yeah,
one session,
hour.
Yeah.
One day.
I think we went back. Actually, we had to go back to change a few things. But basically we did it in a day in this studio in South Crystal Palace, which is in South London.
Wow.
8-track studio.
Oh, 8 tracks, woo.
Yeah, I know. It's big. It's too much almost. It's almost intimidating having 8 tracks, Because you feel like you have to fill them up. I don't think we did. I think we didn't feel 8 tracks, but... yes, and that was the first single after Warm Leather Red, and that's kind of I guess that's really when the label started as a label rather than just a personal project,
Wow.
And that was 79 at some point.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's like me publishing. I never thought I'd be a publisher, and then I just ended up doing it. But it was
exactly the same, yeah. Which is a good way, you just fall into it. It's part of your natural, flow or whatever. It just happens, and I guess you get drawn in like that, you know. And then all of a sudden, it's 40 years late when you're still doing it, you know. How long's research been
going?
Well,
since I actually tried to start in 76, but I didn't succeed till 77 because I had no training or art school or any of that.
Okay.
It took a long time to crawl up from the primeval ooze.
Sure.
So, yeah.
So, yeah. You just end up doing it, and then you realize you've been doing it most of your working life, you know?
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, it is weird. But I guess you have to a certain extent, you have to enjoy it, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it, right?
Oh, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, with hope.
Yeah.
Most of it, at least.
Yeah. I've got a 50% rule.
What's that?
If I'm enjoying it 50% or more, it's fine.
Wow.
Because there's some days you just hate every moment of it. It's just like one problem after another. And another day it's like unbelievable, and you hear a great song that you've been working on with somebody. Yes, it's just a rough guide, you know. Because I have to, you know, I have to kind of monitor it, monitor my own. You know, especially as you get older, you want to make sure you're doing what you want to do. You know, at least 50% of the time, which I think 50% of the time is pretty good. Percentage, don't you?
Yeah, it's damn good. That sounds more like 20%, but 20% maybe is almost enough. I don't know.
Yeah, probably is. It probably is, yeah.
I mean, you're sleeping hours a day. So.
Yeah, that's true.
But then you're supposed to be enjoying your dreams.
Yeah, 50% is ambitious, maybe, but that's just like, it's just a rough guideline. You know, I don't write down every day. That minute was like 20%. That minute was 80%. When I do work out an average, it's not.
Oh
quite,
yeah,
it's not quite a scientific.
The 20 to 80.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an app.
The
that will
golden
do that.
Mean.
I'm sure there's an app that I can will do that for me. You know, that will measure. I just measure my enjoyment, my level of happiness, and work it out at the end of the day.
Oh God,
with little probes on.
Yeah, little probes. Yeah.
So you just basically took the money, if any money came in, you lived. Probably fairly minimally, and just plowed it into the next record, and the next record, and the next record, and then eventually it becomes a so-called business.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, as I said, by today's standards, the first single sold really well.
I think so.
I couldn't tell you how many.
Numbers.
But enough to keep me going, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't have an office or staff or anything, so... And then it allowed me to finance the Fad Gadget single, and that became an underground hit as well. And
it did.
Then I did a project called the Silicon Teens.
Oh, that was a hit too.
That was actually almost a commercial hit.
Yeah.
Not quite.
Yeah, I remember that order of your record releases. Yeah.
So yeah, the Fad Gadget single was Mute 002, and then the Silicon Teens was Mute 003. Anyway, so, and then, you know, then I met DAF, Deutsche Amerikanische Freundschaft,
right.
And we did a single with Boyd.
Right.
You know, so it's, once I got going, started to do a few...
It was organic.
It was all 7 inches at the time.
Yeah.
No albums or anything like that.
Yeah, I like 7 inches.
Yeah.
That's my favorite format of all time. Because you can just record it super fast, catch the first inspiration, and not be dragged down trying to fill a damn album's worth.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It can be great, an album. Great album is a great album, but it can also be a burden, too. And DAF, that was the first album on Mute, was a DAF album.
Oh, on Mute.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's actually their second album. They did, with a different lineup, they'd done an album on At Attack Records in Dusseldorf, which is a great label we became good friends with. They did things like Der Plan and all those cool, really great stuff.
Yeah, well, Germany was hard to find then. A little less on the radar because I depended so much on those four British weeklies.
Yeah, they didn't cover a lot of that stuff. But
that's why I didn't even know about Neubauten until, practically after I did the Industrial Culture Handbook.
Really?
I would have put them in if I'd known about them.
Yeah. What year was that?
That came out in early 83.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, they were around, I think they started in 80 or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But wait, what was that label in Dusseldorf?
At Attack.
Yeah. At Attack. Thank you. Yeah.
great artwork.
Yeah.
Their plan were kind of sort of residence-like in a way, somehow.
Yes, yes.
Lots of kind of treated vocals and great videos. They made very early on, they were making videos.
Right.
It was more like an art collective, art group, rather than just, the music was part of it, you know.
Yeah, I kind of like stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, the residents of, I guess they're sort of still together here in this town, but...
They just played in London.
They did?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Great.
And I was away, unfortunately, because we released some of the catalogue at a certain point.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Wow.
And some of the guys from the label who went down said it was the best show they'd seen, you know, so... Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we... Wow. So how many records does Mute put out then? Gee, like 100?
Well, over the period of the history?
Yeah, 20, 200? Oh, never mind.
I honestly don't know.
A lot.
It's been going for a long time.
Yeah.
And then we would do catalogs, like we do the Can catalog. So that's, which is incredible for me as a huge fan to be able to work with those guys on the.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a lot of records just in one catalog or the residence.
You mean in a box set or what?
Well, no, just titles. You know, that's a lot of titles. Yeah, we've done various box sets with them and things like that. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So now at this stage of your life, you're going back to your roots and you're DJing and hope having fun.
Very much, yeah, I really enjoy it, yeah. That's 100% fun, almost 100%. If the sound's good and the people are nice, it's 100%. If the sound system isn't good, it's not so good. But last night I played here and the sound, great sound system, really nice people, and had a lot of fun, yeah.
Wow, and who sets up your tour and all that stuff?
Well, it's not exactly a tour, but I have an agent.
Oh, an agent.
DJ agent.
DJ agent, yeah, I know. Okay.
Sounds very posh. Well, I got back into it a few years ago. A friend of mine called Carl O'Connor, who goes under the name of Regis. His DJ name, his artist name is Regis. He had a party at Berghain in Berlin, which is like one of the most famous techno clubs out there. And he foolishly or whatever encouraged me to play. And he said, yeah, I was a bit reluctant. He said, no, you can do it, you can do it. And it's like playing, I don't know what the equivalent, in England I would say it's the equivalent of playing Wembley Stadium, but it's like, I guess, it's the equivalent of playing your first football game at Dodger Stadium. Or
Jesus.
Is that a football ground here? Is that football? Is that baseball?
Yeah,
that?
I get it. Huge.
But hugely important. It's not a huge, not physically that huge, but in terms of, it's where it's like, it's only about 800-900 people maybe.
That's a lot.
But in terms of, it's kind of importance in that world. It's huge.
Oh yeah, very.
And I just enjoyed it so much. I had to do it. And a friend of mine who in Berlin is an agent, and I asked her if she'd be my agent. And she said yeah. And of course I'm not, full time. It's not my full time job, but she gets me gigs that I, you know, neither of us are relying on it to make a living, and so she can pick and we can pick and things that I want to do and places I want to go to, and you know, and most of the time it's great. There's occasionally when it doesn't work out, but most of the time it's really great.
That reminds me, how did you come to tell me that you're now live in Berlin and London?
My home is in London.
Okay.
But I spent a lot of time in Berlin for. We have an office in Berlin, I've been going to Berlin regularly since the early 80s. And I just love the city and have friends there, and I like to spend time. I actually prefer it to London as a place to be.
Hmm. It's more relaxed. Even horrible winters?
Well, the winters in London aren't amazing either, you know.
Oh, okay.
They're not quite as brutal as the Berlin winters, I grant you. But, yeah, I mean, I don't live in, I mean, I'm on the road a lot doing various things, you know, I'm travelling, and so I'm not. The percentage of time, any one place is fairly low, so.
Wow. Well, that sounds sort of interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have a wife or any of that stuff?
I have a girlfriend who lives in Berlin, which is another reason I'm spending time in Berlin.
Oh, that's the real reason. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No, I don't have a wife or any of that, or kids or anything like that. No.
Okay.
Didn't quite. I don't know. Somehow that wasn't on the schedule.
Yeah.
I think my assistant didn't put it on the. It wasn't on the to-do list. You know. I don't know. I have to complain to somebody about that. You know.
Yeah, but I like the way this guy answers things. He never says I don't. He says not yet.
Yeah, not yet. Well.
Wow. Okay. So then you have the freedom to more or less travel around do all this. I mean, when you were traveling before, were you always traveling for your label, so to speak?
Do you mean?
Well, like when you came over here with Boyd. That was in the 80s.
Yeah, I'm sure I was here on for work.
Yeah.
With reasons of some description or other, yeah. I can't remember specifically, but yeah, it would have been, yes. It would have been something, maybe it was a, I honestly can't remember what that, maybe it was a gig, I can't remember. But I went to Los Angeles quite a lot in those days, still do.
Oh, yeah.
Because we were working with, you know, a lot of the artists we were working with were licensed to Warner Brothers, to Sire Records.
Oh.
And so I'd be over here a fair amount, not so much in San Francisco, but because Boyd was here, I think I probably came here to see Boyd,
yeah,
hang out with him for a few days.
Oh, I forgot that Sire Records is a, you know, part of Warner Brothers, and they did a lot of punk records.
There's Seymour Stein, who started. Is a bit of a kind of mentor for me, or you know, he's a great guy, and I learned a lot from him.
Wow, yeah, he came on the first Ramones tour in 76, or maybe it was the second.
And the thing, you know, he was the first American kind of industry person to get interested in what was going on in the UK.
Hmm.
And I remember he used to fly into London, and the first stop would be, on his way to the hotel, would be to go to the Rough Trade shop.
Wow.
And ask, what you got, anything good, you know, give me everything, you know. He's a great guy, he's a really great guy, he's still super active, and it's wonderful to know him, you know.
Yeah.
Super. His musical knowledge is just like beyond anybody's. Like,
wow.
All, you know, from jazz, doo-wop. He'll start singing. He's got a terrible singing voice, but he loves to sing. And he'll sing doo-wop records or Echo and the Bunnymen or, you know, whatever, you know, all over. You know, his knowledge is incredible.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure your knowledge is pretty up there too.
Not really. I mean, I know quite a lot about the stuff that I know about.
Yeah.
But not super broad, you know. People are surprised when they come around to my place that I don't have a huge record collection. Because I don't have a big record collection. I have this thing about, I don't really want music in my house that I don't really like. Do you know what I mean? So, and there's not that much that I really like. It never has been all my life. Even when I was a kid, when I was growing up with music, I was always very specific. There was only like two or three things that I liked. So I don't have a huge record collection.
Wow.
But the things I do have, I like a lot, you know. And I don't have a huge file collection on my computer either. I get stuff. I mean, streaming, even though from a business point of view, it's not great, but from a personal point of view, I find it really useful because you don't have all this stuff that you've got on your hard drive or on your record, you're just listening. It's a good discovery thing. Obviously, if there's something I like, I'll buy it. Of course. I have to say that, don't I?
Yeah, it's good for discovery. Almost anything anyone tells you about, you just go and go to YouTube, and there it is. It's scary. I mean, it's scary from an artist standpoint.
Yeah, it is. But, you know.
It's like radio, I guess, but it's sort of radio on demand. We used to spend hours hoping one song would come on.
Oh, totally. I remember that. Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know what radio was like for you when you were growing up, but when I was really young, when I was just starting to get into music, when I was like 10 or 11, there was very little. I mean, this was before the pirates.
Yeah.
There was the Light Program, it was called. And that kind of says it all, really. It was kind of, you know, nice songs. And again, you know, it was very heavily unionized. There was a musicians' union. And you were only allowed to play a certain amount of recorded music per hour, because if you played too much recorded music, it would put live musicians out of work. Oh. So most of the recorded, so most of the music on the radio was like big band stuff for, but they would, there was one show on a Saturday morning called Saturday Club, which would play records, and that's why that was, and that was like a 1 hour or 2 hour show, and that sort of thing I listened to, and you'd hope that they play something
you liked.
You liked, and there wasn't. And that was rare, and that's where I first heard the Beatles, for instance, was on there.
Wow.
On that show, I first heard quite a few things. This is pre-John Peel. His name was Brian Matthew.
That was his name.
That was his name. That would have been, I mean, that was really like 63, around then. And then the Pirates started.
Wow.
In 63, 64? Mm. I can't remember roughly.
Wow, we didn't really have the Pirates here.
But you had a lot more, because we just had national radio.
That's right.
BBC, which is national radio, and it was like the light program, which is, well, how I described it, mostly kind of middle of the road pop music, big band stuff. There, they had the home service, which was news and drama and things like that, and then they had, what was it called then? The classical station, I can't remember what it was called. It's called Radio 3 now, I can't remember what it was called then. But it was mostly classical. And that was it. That was the radio. One TV station. But it was great. Listen, a lot of great stuff came out of that, you know.
Now
it's too much choice.
Yeah,
it's, you spend too much time now thinking about stuff and not enjoying it.
Hey, I like that.
Yeah.
Too much choice. Otherwise known as information overload.
Yeah, the tyranny of choice.
That's a weird. We have to think about that. The tyranny of choice.
Well, it's like you're going to a supermarket.
Oh God, thousands.
And there's
of
like,
products.
You know, I want to buy a packet of potato chips.
Yeah.
And you spend a day going through all the different. You know, think, do I want? You know, that's what I mean by the tyranny of choice. You know.
Literally thousands more products at a supermarket than there used to be.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it's a very funny time we're in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how. I don't. People ask me because I'm me. Like, do you think there's any underground now? Well, you guys give me hope because you're dressed in all black. But is, you know what I mean? Is there a unified underground? Excuse me.
I'm not sure about that, because everything is known globally within seconds.
Right.
You know.
That's a problem.
But if you, I think, I mean, I don't know. It's more for these Justin and Rachel to say. Really, they're the ones dressed in black.
Yeah. It's difficult to. Things don't have time to mature.
Yeah.
Definitely an underground. It's definitely fragmented.
That's what I keep getting.
There's no central theme or zeitgeist, you know.
Man, I need to watch that.
It's a little what?
It's a little fragmented. All the energy, you know, where you could centralize more around a concept or a loose concept. And also the idea of imagination where everything is so obvious and, you know, everything's accessible. Where they talk about some people that have written songs. For instance, I remember reading reviews of albums that I couldn't hear or albums I couldn't find.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I read about someone making an album, and basically they said they made their album because there was an impression of a band they never heard. They were just excited about this concept.
Yeah.
So they were just making music they thought it would sound like.
Yeah,
that's great. Like, and I hear a lot about that, about early punk too, where if you're a band that's descriptive, supposed to sound like this, and you have this idea of what they are and who they are, and you're inspired and you make it, and you end up actually you're making your completely own version of something. Where now it's like, you know, you go to SoundCloud or whatever, and that's the sound, and everyone tries to jump on the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I think if you want to be underground, whatever that is, stay offline.
Yeah, I like that.
Don't have a website. Don't put your stuff on SoundCloud. And let it grow at the speed that you want it to be, and the people you want to be involved in it, and let it grow that way. But I don't know if that's just too. abstract for today's
Well, I mean, if world. A friend was over a few days ago, and he used to do all these really illegal stuff, things that I would never have the courage to do, like get inside the Golden Gate Bridge and climb all the way to the top and lead friends to do stuff or break into abandoned mortuaries or buildings and have parties and stuff like that. But and he says, yeah, I met a whole new group of people that are doing that, but they are not online.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Yeah, I think you have to stay offline if you want to do stuff like that. Otherwise, if you're going to break into mortuary.
Especially illegal.
Yes,
illegal stuff. Breaking into the mortuary.
Facebook.
Maybe here, I'm breaking into the mortuary.
Well, they would. They always had this idea, leave no trace. In other words, you're not doing it to destroy property or anything. You just want a free place to have a party and a little bit of thrill of doing something slightly illicit.
But I've got a feeling, you know, there's this whole return to analog stuff.
I love that.
You know, and maybe that will also reflect in people staying offline as well to do certain things, you know. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, cassettes are coming, you know, cassettes.
I know.
I get that. Vinyl I get the vinyl thing. Analog synthesizers, analog cameras, analog everything, you know. It's slowly creeping back into everybody's, you know, people actually realized that it was different and good. There was good things about it, different things. And maybe, stay offline. Maybe hashtag stay offline.
Yes.
Can you have a hashtag stay offline? I'm not sure about that.
Facebook announcement. Yeah, staying Facebook, offline. Yeah. Staying offline.
Yeah, my website is called offline. Yeah. Right.
Definitely think people want something tangible.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it is. And digital by nature is just, it's a simulation. You know, it's just, it's in the ether.
Yeah.
And some people want to, you're human, you want something tangible.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
You know?
Digital by nature, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, at least probably a combination of analog and digital media are bringing you people to your shows, though. You know, you have to have a Facebook page. Daniel Miller in town.
That's what I mean. It's not, as soon as it's out there, it's not definitely an underground gig, you know. But, listen, we use, as a label, of course, we use all that stuff all the time, you know. Yeah. We have to get our music out there to the audience. It's a business. It's what the artists want, to get to the widest possible audience.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely...
Yeah, is this still Mute Records then?
Yeah. Well, actually, technically, it's called Mute Artists now because we... It's another whole story, but I sold Mute to EMI in 2002.
Oh.
I still ran the label, still put out the records, but it was owned by EMI. And then we left as a group and some of the artists in 2010. They continue to own the name, but
EMI does.
Well... Not anymore. They sold it on, so it's now BMG. But so they own the name and the catalog. But they've given us the name to use for forever. So that's. But we don't. But technically, we're called Mute Artists Limited, not Mute Records. But I mean, it's people. Everybody says Mute Records, and we work with BMG.
Well,
they have the catalog, and they, you know, we work together on it. So it's like a friendly-ish kind of relationship.
Well, they do the horrible work of distribution and getting paid.
Yeah.
The worst thing.
Mm. So, it's kind of a marriage of convenience.
Well, it saves you a lot of drudgery, actually. You're having fun.
51% of the time.
51%. Hey, let's change that. 51%
of the time, yeah.
Well, geez. I guess I will. I'll say thank you very much for coming to the research.
It's great to be back here after. Can you remember when?
It was in the 80s.
Was it? Yeah.
I'd say 88 or 9.
Could well be, yeah.
I'll never forget.
It's great to be back. It's great to
be
back. I have to say. And I think it's great that you're still going strong.
Well, I'm going, at least.
Yeah. It looks like with all these great publications and everything.
I have to ship those to LA today.
Yeah.
I think I'll do it tomorrow. Hell with it. Tomorrow. Why rush?
Driving.
Yeah, well, great. So I'm always glad when someone perseveres a long time and doesn't get a day job.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you persevere because there's no option.
Oh, really?
There's no choice. I mean, you know,
you're right. No one would ever hire me. So
I have nothing to fall back on, you know. I don't have a law degree or a medical degree or anything like that. That's what I say when, you know, I occasionally do talks and stuff like that with people who, well, you know, students or something, and they say, "Oh, what advice would you give somebody who wants to start a record label?" I say, the only advice I can give is, you can only do it if you have nothing else, you have nothing to fall back on. You've got, it's the only thing you can possibly do if you're unhirable, you know. Because if you have something to fall back on, you'll fall back on it. So, you know, that's always what I say to people. Just, that's pretty much the criteria. That people I know who run labels, independent labels at least, I think that's, you know, people like Jeff or, you know, that's, I can't imagine any of us doing anything else. You know what I mean? It's like unhirable people, you know.
Yeah. On that note.
On that note.
I know, we always try to leave some inspiration, or rather encouragement.
Yeah.
Because it's the world. Anyway, I mean, we went to like this little gallery that was having their final night two blocks away.
Yeah.
And two different people gave us cassettes. You know, which I like. They made the covers themselves
and
they were doing zines, and we got some of those.
That's great. No, the cassette thing is great because you can do it yourself.
Yes.
Literally, you don't have to go to a pressing plant. You don't have to do anything. And I do like that aspect of it. I guess I need to get a cassette player that works.
Chinatown, there's stores in Chinatown. Yeah, they still have them.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
And everyone has found out that Amoeba Records has some ginormous warehouse, I guess, filled with cassettes, and you can buy them really cheap. I think there might be blank ones.
Oh, okay, blank cassettes.
And then you can start your own cassette label.
I can imagine that it'd be like the vinyl crisis. You know, all of a sudden there won't be anybody making blank cassettes anymore. It's like, it's really hard to get vinyl now. Get it pressed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's so much demand for it.
Wow.
And all the pressing plants kind of closed down years ago. You know, there's just a couple around there. And to get a record pressed, you'd have to book in like 4 months ahead of time, you know. It's becoming, I think people are starting to try and think of how to, and the machines have all been scrapped. You know, all the pressing machines and stuff, because they're just big lumps of steel that nobody wants, you know, wanted. So now people are having to just redesign them and build them, and it's quite a big investment. But the vinyl thing is, I mean, mainstream stores in the UK and Europe are starting to stock vinyl, the equivalent of Walmart.
Wow.
Are stocking vinyl.
Great.
You know.
Wow.
And vinyl, the sale of vinyl players is like the HMV chain, which is a record store chain that sells other stuff as well. Over the Christmas period in the UK, they were selling one record player per minute.
Great.
Vinyl player per minute.
What do you play for your DJ set?
I use digital files on a computer.
On a computer.
Yeah, so I'm not a vinyl purist.
You're not going to carry them around. No, it's too heavy.
First of all, it's too heavy. Second of all, if you check them in, they're going to get nicked. Quite a lot of the time, you know, if you check in vinyl in what's obviously a vinyl case. I've heard that so many people. But that's not really the real reason. The real reason is that I don't want to have to learn how to sync up records anymore, you know, to beat match. And the computer gives me a lot more flexibility about what I can do with the music. So I can have four things running at once and looping and jumping around the tracks, which you can't really do. Well, some people do on vinyl, but they're super highly skilled kind of scratching. So actually the computer's pretty convenient just for me.
You actually carry around a laptop and not just a thumb drive?
I'm old school. I carry a laptop, yeah. Not just a USB drive, yeah.
Well, you need it. You probably have a program.
Yeah,
you're not just hitting a playlist. Yeah.
No, there's a program called Traktor, which I use.
character.
Am I allowed to mention brand names on here?
Of course.
And
we want to know everything.
Help sponsor.
And there's a controller, like a mixer that controls the computer. And that's
you carry that too.
Yeah.
What's the brand of that?
That is the Native Instruments Traktor S5, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
Available at all your local music stores.
Wow. Oh, that goes with the program.
Yeah, it goes with, yeah.
Okay.
But the controller, isn't that the thing with little sliders and knobs?
Yeah. It looks like a mixer, really.
A mixer.
But it does more than that. But yeah, that's what it is, really.
And so that's what you have to travel with.
Yeah, I can do it without that.
Hmm.
I can do. I can also have a software on my iPad that I can use to run it. But it's not so much. It's not so good. It's not so much fun as doing it with a. It's not so physical. And I like the kind of physical.
So you have a laptop and a physical
and
thing.
A controller, yeah.
Controller.
Yeah.
And that's not too heavy to carry around.
No. I mean, that goes in hand luggage, you know. I don't have to check that in. I would never check that in.
Good. That's a tip.
Yeah, I mean,
survival tip.
Yeah, never. Yeah.
Never check.
Never check. I'd hate. Yeah, I mean, this is quite a long trip I'm on now, so yeah. I've got a second bag with clothes and stuff in it, which I do have to check in. But I would never check in the DJ stuff. It's definitely going. No, it won't get stolen probably, but it'll get lost. You know,
yeah,
for sure.
You can always buy clothes.
It's that moment, you know, when the carousel's coming round and you're the last person there. And you're standing there, it's an empty carousel, everybody's walked off with their bags, and you're the only one left standing there waiting for, you know, it's that moment I've had too many times. You know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez, okay, that's a life lesson.
Yeah. Well, if you're relying on, you can always buy clothes anywhere, right?
Yeah, any.
So, you know,
buy that long raincoat anywhere.
Buy a long raincoat anywhere, yeah.
Why, I wanted to ask you why you wore that long raincoat. I figured, well, if you get stuck in sleeping at night in an airport, you can just wrap yourself in it and go to sleep.
I don't remember. Was it winter when I came? Was it?
Yeah, it must have been.
It must have been winter, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember the rain. I mean, I vaguely remember the raincoat.
Ankle length, black.
Really?
Okay. Oh, yeah, black. Yeah. I don't remember stuff like that.
Yeah. Funny, yeah.
Hey, you're healthy. What's your favorite foods? What do you eat? Do you eat any old thing?
No, I'm careful. I'm very careful. Partly because I put on weight very easily.
Yeah.
And so I try to eat. I was a vegetarian for years.
Mm.
But I'm not anymore.
Right.
But I try and eat healthy, yeah. I try not to eat junk food or processed food. I want to keep going, you know, for a while if I can.
Yeah. Good. Do you drink coffee?
No. I gave up coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I drink tea.
Yeah. I made some tea for you, but we never served it.
And, just try to eat healthy stuff. How about you?
No, I'm trying now to eat as many salads as I can put my way.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of salads, vegetables, green vegetables.
Yeah, real food.
Yeah.
Real vegetables.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very lightly steamed.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to keep going, right?
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah, exactly. Put good fuel in, you know.
Yeah, it's fuel.
Yeah.
We are machines.
Mm.
We need good fuel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Wow, good.
All right.
Anyone else? What did I leave out?
Tons,
I'm sure, lots. But
we could turn this into a cookery show, I guess. We do our favorite recipes.
Part 2.
Yeah, part 2.
Recipes.
I once, this is a slightly off subject story, but I was somewhere in Germany, and it's a really weird kind of Ballardian combination of things. Not very nice either, but
that's all right.
I was in my hotel room, and I just turned the TV on, and Blixer Bargeld was doing a cookery show. He was on a very mainstream cookery show, because fancies himself as a bit of a gourmet, right? And he was on this mainstream cookery show doing his black squid pasta, whatever it's called. It's black pasta, basically. Yeah, and he was on this TV show, and that was and I remember the host, really super mainstream kind of German TV show, And one of the things that the guest had to do at the end of the show was to pick the wine to eat with the meal. And Blixer, who is a wine expert, the host picked the most expensive wine of any of our guests ever. And I turned the TV off and I went out somewhere with Depeche Mode, we were doing something, I can't remember. Came back to the hotel, turned the TV on, and Princess Diana, they announced that Princess Diana died.
Wow.
That was kind of a really odd
thing.
Mm. Wow. But the Blixer, but the, I really mentioned that because Blixer on the cookery show. If he can do it. He also did an ad campaign for power tools. I don't know if you know that, in Germany.
That kind of makes sense.
Yeah, now that makes sense.
He's actually a good advocate for power tools.
Yeah.
Multi-purpose, you know.
Right.
I'm sure they're online somewhere. I can't remember which power tools they were.
German brand, I hope. Yeah. They're probably the best.
Yeah.
Anything German. Mm. That's so funny. Yeah, my friend in Devo has his own wine label now.
Yeah. What's
it called? 7x7 or darn, this
something
is our,
like that.
This is our chance to
8
plug
by
it.
10?
No, it's 7x7.
Who is it? From which one from Devo?
It's not Mark Mothersbaugh. My friend is Jerry Casale, the bassist.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
And anyway, yeah, he should be up here soon checking the grapes. Because it's all coming from Napa.
Yeah, that's right. That's where we're going later, actually.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well.
Are you going to have dinner, wine, whatever dinner?
Yeah. We're going to meet. Do you know Dave Smith? Dave Smith, he's a synthesizer builder.
Oh, wow.
From the old days, but he's doing stuff now. He's down there. So we were going to design and build. He owns a synthesizer company. Yeah. Famous one.
Wow.
Yeah, we're supposed to go to their office. After this.
Yeah.
Where's the office?
It's like right up the street.
Yeah.
It's near Washington
Square. Our intern worked for him.
Oh, right.
Andrew or
Lambert.
Lambert.
Andrew Lambert.
Yeah, we have our former intern works for him.
That name sounds familiar.
Andrew Lambert.
Yeah.
He's a really tall kid.
Yeah.
Thin.
Yeah, thin. He's a musician too. Yeah, wow. That's only a block away.
Yeah,
it's
a few blocks away or something like that.
Yeah.
So.
But I thought you're also going to Napa today.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the guy whose company it is in Napa, so we're going to go.
Yeah, Dave is north of here right now.
Yeah.
I think he's came back from a trip or something.
But
so he's not at the office.
He's not at the office.
He's not at the office.
Okay, I'm
so
putting it together.
He normally is. So,
yeah.
So he's on a trip or something.
Yeah.
I guess he was.
It's on Stockton Street or something.
It's really close. I was
really
surprised. I saw the intern. I hadn't seen him in 5 years.
Okay.
He's like, oh, I work right there now, building synthesizers. And we didn't know that was in the neighborhood.
Yeah. It must
that's pretty
been.
Cool.
That's
I mean,
amazing.
Yeah.
He was the inventor of MIDI, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
That is cool. Wow.
Full agenda. So your work is done. Your show was yesterday.
That was last
now.
Night, yeah. Now we're just having a little tour around.
Now you're off the hook.
Have a look around, which is nice. Nice to have people to show me around.
Right.
Oh, no, you have to.
Yeah.
Everywhere you travel, you've got to have some local
people
helping
you.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, we learned that a long time ago. You have to ask for it. It won't just appear.
Yeah.
You must ask.
Yeah.
Great.
Do you live
in
the city?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I figured you both lived here.
Yeah, I live here. I'm originally from the East Coast.
Oh.
So I'm from Baltimore.
Oh, we love Baltimore.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild place.
Yeah, we loved it last March when we went there. We got invited to do a presentation at the Baltimore Zine Fest.
Okay.
That's cool.
You know, I know, but then we thought, God, maybe we should move here. And then it turned out every single person who was nice to us was leaving. We were horrified.
Well,
that feels like here
reasons
now.
To leave.
Pardon?
That feels like here. So many people are saying that.
Oh, it's horrible here. Hundreds.
Yeah.
Hundreds of people I know have been forced out. I don't like it, but anyway.
You're still here?
Yeah, well, we won't talk about that.
No.
Don't want to jinx anything.
No, sure. Of course.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll... Anytime you're in town, come by and we'll do part two.
Okay.
Right.
I don't know if there's a part two, but yeah, we'll try and do that. No,
well,
it was great
there's
to
plenty
see
to talk about, always.
Yeah, of course. But great to see you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for inviting me to
bringing Daniel here, you two.
It's cool. That's my name.